no more room in hell. The dead will walk the earth.
Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. Today, we're going to be test talking with Matt Barber, a senior director of engineering at Comcast Silicon Valley, about his awesome presentation he gave at Star East this year on lessons learned about end-to-end testing from Zombieland. So if I was you, I would listen up and discover how to escape the coming test automation zombie apocalypse. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Matt, welcome to Test Talks.
Thank you for having me.
It's awesome to finally have you on the show. But before we get into it, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm the Senior Director of Engineering for Comcast Silicon Valley. I'm responsible for applications on Comcast's X1 platform, which is a cloud-based guide. And so the applications themselves are cloud-based. And my background is I actually came from the semiconductor test industry. I was formerly working at a place called Teradyne and some other startups around that. And I switched to software and kind of now I'm here.
Awesome. Yeah. So I guess today what I really like to focus on is your presentation you gave at Star East this year about lessons learned on end-to-end testing from Zombieland. So why zombies, I guess, is the first thing we should start with. You know, what can we learn from automation from zombies or zombie movies?
Yeah. So, you know, I got to admit the title is a little bit of, it was kind of a hook, but where I was kind of thinking was, so end-to-end testing on devices, you're dealing with the real world chaos that ensues when you kind of get out of your nice, safe unit testing, kind of component level testing world, right? And what I was kind of thinking of, well, what's a good analogy to that? And I was like, well, it's kind of like a zombie apocalypse. It's unpredictable in terms of what sort of things are happening and what sort of things you can control. A lot of it you can't control. So you have to have a kind of a strict code of rules to follow that will kind of guide you through the chaos and hopefully arrive at the end with a good set of working tests.
So yeah, I definitely agree. There's definitely a lot of chaos in end-to-end testing. Pretty much every automation framework I've been involved with, that's end-to-end testing is chaos. So then you then go on to have a bunch of different rules, and they're kind of funny, you know, the different rules you have. So I guess the first thing you go over, though, is the PARM theory. So what is the PARM theory?
So the PARM theory is my attempt at trying to come up with something that gives you, how to put it, but like a guidance around, well, what do I need to focus on to make my tests worthwhile? And it's kind of influenced by the CAP theorem in distributed computing, which states that, you know, in any distributed system, you can either be consistent, available, or partition tolerant, but you can't have all three, right? It's just not possible to be completely one of all three of them. And so I was thinking about that. Well, how does that apply to end-to-end tests? And as it turns out, you know, end-to-end testing in real devices has actually a lot of lessons to be learned from distributed computing and just DevOps in general. And so I said, well, okay, what makes a test, an automated test, really useful? Well, it definitely needs to be able to be run fast. So that's the P, performant. It needs to be accurate. It needs to give you something relevant as a result. And that's the A for accurate. Additionally, it needs to be repeatable. So you need to be able to get the same results each time. And that's the R. And of course, at the end, you know, even if you have a performant, accurate, and repeatable test, if it's not meaningful, it's kind of a waste of a test, right? And so that's the M. So P-A-R-M, PARM. In the course of my talk, I was kind of using that as a vehicle to kind of say, well, this rule kind of helps you focus on this part of the PARM matrix, for lack of a better term.
Awesome. I think it's a really great model, actually, to help people, like you said, focus on, see what they're working on, and make sure that they're addressing all these areas. Mm-hmm. So I guess you'll probably get to it later on, but meaningful, what do you mean by meaningful? Is this so you don't have a bunch of extra tests that really aren't doing anything and you have a bloated test suite?
Yeah. I think the best way I could describe that is when you're writing tests, there's stuff that's kind of easy to do. You know, like a great example is if you have a class that's got like getters and setters, you know, you could write unit tests that check your getters and setters, right? But that reality is that's probably not getting you very much in terms of actual meaningful test coverage, right? The tests, I'm sure you can make those tests, you know, all other phases of the PARM matrix. You can make them performant and accurate and meaningful and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, are you really gaining anything from this thing? And that was kind of what I was hoping to focus on with that was, and if you extrapolate that out to an acceptance level test, and, you know, our teams, we uniformly in our office, we actually use Cucumber in an open source framework called Zucchini that kind of allows us to go horizontal. And we'll talk about that later, I guess. But the best way I can describe it is when you're doing like acceptance tests and you have, you know, feature files and things like that, a lot of times people end up writing tests in such a way where they either kind of trying to do too much or not doing enough. That's kind of where the meaningful part comes in my mind, at least.
The next thing you get into is know your way out of it to aim for excellence and not tolerate mediocrity. Once again, a lot of times I think it's easy for teams to become complacent with test automation and it just becomes a checkpoint on a list of to-do things to complete their sprint. But how do we avoid that, I guess?
Yeah, this is really the one that I would say is probably the hardest one to do because it's kind of it's a cultural change. It's basically you're looking at the way I was describing it in my talk was there's a term that kind of, or there's a phrase that you might hear periodically that perfectly describes this phenomenon, which is that's the way we've always done it, right? I'm positive everyone who's worked for any amount of time has heard someone say that as an example why they're doing something, right? And to me, that is like one of my least favorite phrases in the English language because it basically implies that what we're doing is good enough and there's no reason to improve it. And I think there's hardly ever a situation where that's really actually the truth, you know. And even if you haven't said that or heard someone say it in your team, there's other symptoms of it, you know, like a low pass rate or, you know, your tests don't finish quickly enough. Or like I was saying before, if you can't tell me what this test is doing and why you have it, things like that, right? So to me, the thing there is if you have these kind of symptoms, it leads to an engineering team that, as you said, just kind of ends up checking the box saying we have automated tests, and you could get to that situation where you have 100% unit test coverage and they don't actually do anything, you know, you know, or, you know, like one that happens a lot, it actually happened a lot in our org before we started kind of focusing on this was, you know, you get to about 75% pass rate, 85% pass rate, and you're like, hey, that's not bad. But the reality is you still have 15% of your tests that are failing and you don't know why, you know? And so it's like, well, okay, well now we spend an hour per test or hour per week or hour per day or something just trying to debug why test X failed, right? And it's just such a waste of time that, you know, had we taken the time up front to do the test in a way that was really well done, the theory here, and I believe it's been validated by my experience is that you spend the time up front and you'll kind of reap the benefits later on because you're not spending all this time debugging all these false failures, right? You can kind of believe in the results that you're seeing.
Absolutely. And there's so many things here that you just mentioned that I agree with. And it is a cultural issue and every company is different. And man, culture issues are the hardest things to fix. So I definitely agree with you there. There's one thing that you brought up that, you know, when someone says this is the way we've always done this, and I know with larger companies, I've seen this more often, but maybe it's just because of my experience. And I was just reading something recently about agile is not a noun. And he brought up a point where, you know, your process should change over time. And if it doesn't, then there's something wrong. And it sounds pretty similar to what you're saying about your testing, that things change over time and you should be looking at it. It shouldn't always be the same, because if they are, then there's something probably wrong there.
Yeah. Either. And if your tests are working the whole time, then it means your product is probably not advancing either, you know?
All right. So as we're testing, we're doing our automation, how does the buddy system come into play, both with zombies and with test automation?
Well, okay. So before my current role, I was just director of test engineering. We actually had a QA org in our office, and you know, that was great. And you know, at some point we decided to flatten the org and say we don't have a dedicated QA org. We kind of embed our QA engineers with development teams, and you know, as a result, I ended up taking over ownership of quite a few things end to end, right? And what it got me thinking about was, well, a lot of times when I was kind of just dealing with things on the test end, a thing we would always have trouble with is we'd have these really great software engineering test engineers, and they kind of, a lot of times they would have this inferiority complex saying, you know, it's like, well, I'd ask them to do something, or I'd ask them to like look into certain things. And it would be like, you kind of got the impression that it was like, well, that seems like a development task. And what I kept trying to stress was, yeah, writing automated tests is a development task. And really there's rigor around development, and really you're writing automated tests. This should be as good or better than the code you're testing. You know, like going back to my days in semiconductor testing, it was like, if you're testing a clock at 100 megahertz, you need it, and looking for jitter in the picosecond range, you need something that can measure, you know, a clock at 200 megahertz and femtosecond accuracy, right? And it's like, if you don't have that, you're kind of destined to not get what you really want out of development or out of the tests. And so, you know, the thing I was trying to espouse with this was, yeah, writing automated tests should be treated no differently than developing code for the application under test. And to me, that means, you know, if you're a good test developer, you need to know design patterns. You need to kind of do unit tests, static code analysis, code review. A lot of these things that are out there are just as accepted practice in the development world. A lot of times I don't see those occurring in the test world. And I feel like it's a major gap that you need to overcome in order to really be able to write really great tests.
Once again, 100% agree with this. Test automation, you are basically developing a piece of software that tests another piece of software. So, all right, how about check the back seat? And I don't know, I guess I haven't seen many zombie movies, but are there always zombies in the back seat that you're not aware of?
They kind of pop up in the back and driving and kind of grab you, right? Okay. Yeah, I mean, so this one, you're bringing along an unwanted passenger, right? In the same way, you can do the same thing with dependencies. The starting point with this whole thing is, if you aren't using a dependency management tool for whatever language you're writing your tests in, you probably have a problem here. You know, things like Maven or NPM, or, you know, I'm sure there's a dependency management system for pretty much every language that's out there. Bower is one, yeah. And so, you know, I feel like without that, you're just asking for problems. But even if you do have that, you know, a lot of them allow for transitive dependencies where, you know, you say, well, I depend on this artifact, but this thing depends on blah, blah, blah. And as a result, those things can overwrite whatever you've kind of specified in your dependency tree. You know, and this is another thing, another kind of lesson learned from development, DevOps kind of practices and good distributed computing kind of the world there. In order to get repeatable deployments of software, you need to lock down everything, dependencies, everything. It must be 100% repeatable. And to me, it's a similar problem with tests, which is if you're allowing some of your dependencies to kind of override whatever you know you need in your tests, you're just asking for problems, because what if they change theirs, it overwrites yours, and now you've got this test that you haven't changed anything, it's been working fine, and all of a sudden now it starts breaking, right? So you're just inviting unwanted passengers in your car, so to speak.
Awesome. And just make sure I understand this correctly. Maybe I'm actually guilty of this. So we use Maven. And so are you saying like you should watch out before, you know, sometimes I just like, oh, there's a library for that. I'll just pull it into my palm and have a dependency there. But yeah, you do this too many times, it gets bloated, and there may be dependencies, even though Maven is supposed to be taking care of this in the background, you may have different dependencies that are overwriting other files that they use that you're not aware of. Okay.
Yeah. And so here, a great example, this happens a lot, I've found, is with like, you know, Apache HTTP client, you know, just the standard HTTP libraries a lot of people use. A lot of times you'll kind of pull in some dependency that seems kind of normal, and maybe you're depending on version 2 of HTTP client, and for some reason you're not forwards compatible with version 4 yet, or, you know, for whatever reason. If you happen to pull in some dependency that is compliant with HTTP client 4 or whatever, that version is going to be higher than the one you have specified in your POM, and without kind of locking that down, it's just going to override it and say, oh, well, he probably wanted the newer one because he didn't say explicitly give me this version. And so it's going to end up pulling in this version 4 of HTTP, and now your tester is going to break.
I guess the next rule is cardio. And I like this. It says, looking for opportunities to obtain useful test metrics outside of traditional tests. So metrics are kind of tricky for me. Different teams, sometimes they'll gauge a metric if you give it to them. So what is a meaningful metric to them?
So, yeah. So what I was thinking with this was, you know, a lot of times you'll have a requirement that says something like, memory use is a good example. Like maybe you have maybe your application shouldn't ever go beyond 80% memory utilization in the course of normal usage. You know, that could be defined, that seems like a requirement that would be reasonable for someone to specify for some product, right? And so you could go and actually write a test that goes and exercises the product and is monitoring memory the whole time, right? But another way you could actually achieve a pretty similar, if not the same result, is to actually just run your functional test that you will presumably have written for this thing, which generally kind of exercise the product in a way that would be considered normal. And then as part of those tests, just have something that's monitoring the memory on this thing over time. And as a result of that, you can actually skip writing that additional test because you kind of have the data already for, you know, to validate that.
All right. So the next one is limber up. Make sure your test tools scale. And I guess it says make sure they go parallel in both directions. So what do you mean by that?
A typical problem a lot of people have, I would say probably anyone who's doing web or mobile development, is just your like device compatibility test, right? You got to make sure this thing run, if you're dealing with a mobile app, for example, it has to run on Android N and M and L and, you know, iOS, you know, all these different versions and different makes and models. And you have this big compatibility matrix of these are all the make and models of things I need to test on, right? And especially with mobile, it's just an astounding list, right? So right off the bat, you're probably going to have to pare it down. But even if you don't, you know, running tests on these things, if you're not doing that in parallel, you're just kind of signing up for just an endless run of just serializing these things or doing some weird kind of, you know, using parallelizing, but kind of doing it in a way where you're using your Jenkins or Team City or something and kind of hacking it that way. But really, to me, the kind of the elegant way is to actually have your test framework take care of that for you, right? And that's actually why we wrote Zucchini, which is like an addition to Cucumber. It's actually on GitHub, github.com/comcast/zucchini. But basically, it's like write your Cucumber tests once for one device. And once you kind of have that working, the framework actually just allows you to add any number of additional devices in parallel and it without any additional work. It just kind of works. And, you know, one of the things that, so beyond just device compatibility tests, though, that being able to do things in parallel is really kind of it's a really powerful tool if you use it correctly. Another example I like to use is let's just assume that you have just a single device that you need to test against, right? One way you can actually kind of get, I wouldn't say it's for free, but it's cheap to get good, to get another useful metric here is run two instances of the same device, kind of run the same test in parallel on them at the same time and see what the results are. And you should, if you've written your test right, you should be able to see that those tests results are identical, right? Because theoretically you're not susceptible to, if you ran them in serial, you might, you know, a service that you depend on might be behaving slightly different at the same time. You know what I mean? It's like you kind of get this free metric of, well, how reliable is my test, right? If I can run this thing twice at the same time, I might be able to know that this test is a little bit more reliable than something where kind of get one passing, one failing, or both failing, or, you know, whatever. I think once you've kind of looked at that, the next thing to look at is, you know, so I would call that kind of parallel testing horizontal scaling, right? Where it's just same test replicated on n number of devices. But beyond that, you know, the next thing is to think about, well, how do I run more tests in parallel? And this, you know, the one of the downsides of doing horizontal scaling is that you're still limited by how slow your slowest test is. Basically, you're gonna get a whole bunch of tests that execute slowly, and you'll get one long one, and then a bunch of other slow ones, another long one, and ultimately the sum of all those is your test time. But if you were able to do something in a way where you pipeline them in such a way where you run test one and two on two different devices, and you run test three on a separate device, these are all the same device, you end up with your total test time is really determined by whatever your slowest test is.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I definitely agree with that. I don't know where I heard it, but I heard Facebook was able to do it in such a way that their slowest, whatever the slowest test was, that's how long it took to run the whole entire test suite. And I don't know if they use Docker or something to just throw up instances of an environment for each single test, but that sounds like what you're getting at. You need to be able to scale up so you don't have this bottleneck eventually.
Yeah, and I think I actually saw somebody from Facebook presented at a GTAC last year with that, and it was exactly that. I think as I recall, they hadn't open sourced it, so I was a little bummed about that. But it definitely seemed like it seemed like exactly what you're talking about, where they had effectively an unlimited supply of devices, whether they were simulators or real or whatever. And that's the one downside of trying to do all this is, you know, in order to be able to do highly parallel testing, you really actually have to have effectively an unlimited supply of devices to test against. Otherwise, you kind of have to start making compromises. One other thing I wanted to touch on too was looking at the test tools that you use in general, right? Because there's just making your test scale, but then there's also making it so that your test authoring scales. There was a great example we had internally, which was, you know, I mentioned we're in charge of applications for X1, and for the longest time, the way you could automate tests against those was using kind of a proprietary language and proprietary everything, and so it meant a whole lot of tribal knowledge and a lot of people that, like, it was basically like when you tried to bring somebody up, it would take months, right? Because they'd have to go ask the right people and read the right docs, some of which were out of date. It was just kind of a mess. And so what a few of my tools engineers and I went to Selenium conference last year, and we kind of had an epiphany there, which was, well, what's the industry standard for writing automated tests for mobile and web? It's Selenium, right? And WebDriver. And that in and of itself is actually not specific to web and mobile. It's actually just an API. And so we said, well, what if we could make it in such a way where we've got this proprietary way we can interact with the devices? What if we abstracted in such a way where our test authors could actually just write Selenium tests for this thing? And it turns out we were able to actually implement that, and the results have been great. I mean, I think, you know, it's really easy to find people that can write Selenium code, and it takes a small amount of time to get them up to speed on just the technology in which the application is authored, but they don't really have to know anything more than that. You know, so we found really great success with that. And I feel like that's one thing that a lot of companies that have a similar problem, which I know that exists out there, I feel like that's a really great opportunity to really improve how well your tests scale.
Is this how I think Appium came along? Is they just, because Selenium uses an API instead of JSON wire protocol, that is, as long as you can write to that protocol, it doesn't matter. Is that what you mean? Like, you're able to write to that wire protocol?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's exactly right. Like the way Selenium works on just your browsers now is, and Appium as well, is it's kind of a server client model where the browser that you have running on your computer or something has some kind of proprietary way in which you would be able to write tests for it. And they have these, like, you know, Chrome, for example, they have a Chrome driver that kind of speaks Chrome's native language and exposes the API. And so then any Selenium client, whether it's Java or JavaScript or whatever else, can actually just talk with that in a way where that is agnostic to whether you're running on Chrome or running Firefox or whatever else. And it's a similar problem with us in our platform as well.
All right. So I guess as we're scaling, as we're running in parallel, I guess the danger here is, and it comes to your next point, is when something fails, you need to know why it fails. So don't be a hero. Is that something you mean by don't be a hero? You need to know when it fails, why it fails. And especially if you're running in parallel, you can't go, well, it could be running because I have, it could be failing because I have 20 assertions. Which one failed? I don't know.
Yeah. And at Starace, actually, the gentleman who presented before me, and I wish I could remember his name. I can't remember it, but he had a really great great presentation around this, which was basically like, if you're trying to do too much in a test, you're probably asking for problems. And a situation this happens a lot in, I've noticed, is when people are trying to just convert existing manual tests to automated tests. So, you know, naturally, if you have a set of manual tests, you know, they're going to be broken up into a few different steps. You know, one of them will be like launch the app, and next one is push button X and click button Y, and then look for blah, right? And you know, your natural inclination as a test automation engineer is to say, well, okay, each of those are kind of concrete steps that I can implement, and well, I have the ability to verify these things, so why not? I can verify that the app launched, and I can verify that, you know, I push this button and that button, and I can verify this on screen, and that can work. But, you know, as we'll get to it later, but I think, you know, depending on the test methodology you choose to do those kind of things, you could actually start running some real problems. One of them that classically happens is image comparison, right? You know, your natural inclination is, well, I could just do an image comparison. Why not? You know, and let's assume that your image comparison success rate is like 99%, right? If you have a comparison on each of those steps, you've now compounded your, you know, you're basically saying each time you add one of these things, these image comparisons to your overall test, you're reducing the likelihood that the test is actually going to succeed just because of the nature of the beast with respect to image comparison. And so, you know, if you do four image comparisons in a row and each of them is 99% accurate, you really, at the end of the day, your test is only 96% accurate, right? You know, 99% of 99 of 90, you know, just multiplying them out, you end up with something like that. And it gets a lot worse really quickly if your image comparison success rate is not at 99%. You know, if it's 95 or even 90, you're down to 60% success rate at the end of the day, you know, so it gets really bad really quick. And so one of the things I always like to stress to people, especially when writing BDD, is to favor DAMP phrases over DRY, which, you know, your natural inclination as a developer is to not repeat yourself. And, you know, by doing interesting things with, you know, scenario outlines and Cucumber and things like that, or just in general writing code that kind of makes use of encapsulation and things like that and inheritance. But the reality is, in order to increase the meaningfulness and accuracy of your tests, it's really a lot better to actually describe things in what we call DAMP phrases, which is descriptive and meaningful phrases. And with BDD, it's really obvious when you do that, because you know your BDD scenarios become a lot easier to read and understand, and the whole thing kind of you're able to pass the test of what is this test doing and why do you have it. You know, it's very clear.
No, that's a great point. I definitely agree, damp over dry. How about travel light? So once we get over that, we have our well-written feature files and code. What does travel light mean?
So this is kind of ties into what I was just mentioning, where, you know, even if you've got everything written well, your choice of test methodology can really cause problems. You know, I mentioned image comparison. Record and playback tests are just horrendous for that kind of thing. I think if you're trying to do end-to-end testing using a record and playback tool, you're probably just wasting your time. You know, and another one that I guess we'll get into next is just not controlling your data. You know, I think there's so many different ways that, you know, that you can write tests, even if you've followed all the other rules thus far. You can write a test in which it's just a maintenance nightmare, or it's just unreliable to start from. You know, there's just so many ways you can shoot yourself in the foot with this stuff.
Well, once again, the data management is difficult. I've seen with a lot of different teams, it's a really difficult piece. It's kind of scary how everyone I speak to has the same exact issues. And yeah, I definitely agree with this. So I guess I just need to mention this just in case. I know Moshi is the one that introduced me to you, and I don't know, you don't explicitly say anything about Apply tools or visual validation testing, but is that what you mean by image comparison?
Oh yeah, actually I'd be remiss if I didn't mention them, because I actually think Apply tools does a really great job of solving the image comparison problem for situations where it's merited. You know, I think I still kind of shy away from it where I can, but it actually has, if you can do it well, it really yields great results. And so, you know, I think when I'm talking about image comparison, I'm kind of talking about the thing that a lot of people do, which is just kind of bit comparison. You know, you take a bitmap or a PNG and compare that to a known PNG, just kind of bit by bit. And then you set some threshold and say, if it's 90% successful, then call this a pass. You know, the Apple tools solution is actually really, it's definitely solved a lot of the problems around image comparison, you know, namely image maintenance, intelligent comparisons that can kind of handle slight shifts between things. You know, they really do a good job with that. So I guess that one could be taken off the list if done correctly, you know?
Awesome. Yeah. My company, I'm still waiting for them to get licenses, but I've been using Apply tools for a little bit now and I'm really enjoying it. So I guess along the same lines as test data management, you have another slide talking about control all the data in your system.
Yeah. So this one, this is probably one of the tougher ones from an engineering perspective to do in a lot of cases, because it you know, there's a reason a lot of people don't have kind of mocked out data for their systems, or it's kind of insufficient, is it's really hard to do. And depending on where your data is coming from, you know, the harness that you used to generate the data, the controlled data could be just as complicated as the system you're testing. You know, but my strong opinion is that if you aren't controlling this thing, data, you're just asking to let to have unstable tests, or even worse, letting defects get through to production. I read a lot of books on DevOps and site reliability engineering and whatnot. I find the topic fascinating. One of my favorite quotes from that, I think it came from a Google book on SREs, and I think it applies here, which is, you know, hope is not a strategy. You know, if you just hope that certain things aren't going to happen in real world or whatever, it's going to happen, and that it's just inevitable, right? A great example is we have an application that's a sports application. And sports are a really great example of unpredictable data. You know, live events, you know, there's rain delays, there's overtime, there's cancellations, you know, just weird stuff happens, right? And on top of that, live events, especially with sports, almost always happen, you know, in the evening times on weekends, right? That's kind of generally, they're not happening during working hours, although there's certain cases there are. So, you know, if you're just relying on real data to if you don't have a way to mock out that data, you're basically hoping that, you know, the Sharks Blues game goes to triple overtime. You know, it's just like to see what happens with your app, right? And it's just asking for problems. But one thing I like to stress is that if you don't need to do everything, right? You kind of need to look at what your tests call for and where your tests either can fail or have gaps in terms of coverage, and have something that can get you that kind of data. But you don't necessarily need everything, you know, and it's going to be dependent on the application, but it's kind of a case of start somewhere and start small and just control one thing and see if you can get that to work, and then just start building up from it. You know, I think at the end of the day, you'll be thankful that you've done this, even though it seemed like just an inordinate amount of work. It's so worth it to not have to worry about staying up on weekends and watching games that we might not even want to watch, you know? So
now, one of the funniest points you make, Matt, is the beware of bathroom slide. Can you tell us what is beware of bathrooms?
So this is kind of my favorite slide, actually. What I mean by this is you've done all the heavy lifting on your test side. You really kind of follow all the rules. You've got great tests that in your mind they're written well. They're kind of robust, right? But there's things that can get in the way of performance of these things, and namely the architecture of your system. And using the sports app example again, you know, the data, it's kind of the front end is kind of separate from the data provider for the whole thing. And, you know, it's kind of your typical MVC kind of deployment. But one of the things is that the data provider is actually a shared resource between multiple clients. And so if you're writing a test, you know, let's just, you know, normally you're going to write a test and you're going to start with one device. And then once you kind of have that working, you're going to just throw a bunch of devices on it and scale it out horizontally. And so in this situation, you could be writing tests and you're controlling the data, and, you know, you kind of have your games happening when they should happen, and the scores are predictable and things like that. But it's going to work great with one device, right? You have one client connecting up to the back end, and you're changing the data back in all the time and whatever. It's great. As soon as you throw a second device on there, now you basically have two devices competing for the same resource, right? They're both trying to change the data back in at the same time. And in this case, you know, the first thing I always try and stress to engineers is don't necessarily take for granted that the architecture is the right architecture. You know, like, start from the fact of, okay, well, I've identified this. This is potentially an architectural bug, you know? So the first thing is always to ask, is the application architecture the right architecture for the product as a whole? Not necessarily saying it's the best for tests, right? It's really, is the way it's set up correct, right? And that oftentimes requires talking with some architects and lead developers and things like that, and just making sure everyone's on the same page. And once you've arrived at that, and by the way, if it turns out you found an architectural bug, these are incredibly great, incredibly valuable bugs to have found. But you know, let's assume that that it's not an architectural bug. Now you've got this situation where you got to deal with this. And there's kind of the elegant way and the brute force way. And, you know, I think 5 to 10 years ago, the elegant way probably would have been the right way to go, which is to kind of synchronize your tests, you know, in such a way where, you know, both your or all of your things in parallel aren't modifying the same data resource at the same time. But that adds a decent amount of complexity to your tests, right? Because now you're having to deal with gating between threads and things like that. And we actually added some capability to do that into Zucchini. And then we started looking into using it, and what we realized was, well, we're deployed into, we use OpenStack for deployment, and you know, Amazon be a similar thing, but VMs are effectively free at this point. I mean, they're so cheap, and it's so easy to spin them up and tear them down, especially if you're working in a virtualized environment, that why not just stand up a duplicate instance of your system, right? Such that, you know, it's identical because, you know, we're deployed in a way where server deployments are repeatable and we can deploy n number of servers at any point in time. And it's really no big deal. And well, what if we just said, well, we want to do 20 devices in parallel. Why don't we actually just stand up 20 different stacks? It's kind of short lived. They'll live only for the time that you're running the test. But the reality is now you don't have to make your test complicated at all. You can actually have the test run, you know, in the same way that you would have run on a single device. You can run it in parallel, and it's really no big deal. And I think cloud deployments are really great for that kind of thing. And so this is a case where, you know, the elegant solution might kind of earn you street cred, but really probably the easiest thing to do is just throw hardware at it, you know?
Once again, I 100% agree with you. So you mentioned Zucchini, and I think there's a few other tools that you actually use at Comcast often. Could you just tell us a little bit more about tools that you've recommend others taking a look at? I think you have open sourced some things that you've done at Comcast.
Yeah. So we try, I really strive. So I believe wholeheartedly in contributing and just being a member of the open source community. I think I really strive for our team to anything that we've done internally that has application outside of what we're doing. I really stress to the team to get it out there and open source it. Cause I really believe that, you know, we make use of a lot of open source stuff. And I feel like a lot of stuff that we do would be helpful for other people that are kind of in a similar situation. So, you know, Zucchini is one I mentioned that is cucumber testing in parallel. Oh, by the way, all this stuff is just on github.com/Comcast. Zucchini is one that we do that is kind of core to almost all of our tests. Basically every test in my org and actually all the tests in our office are using Zucchini as their means for executing cucumber feature files and also scaling out horizontally. We have a device management tool that we created called DAWG, D-A-W-G. And that one is really interesting because in our situation, we're dealing with set-top boxes most of the time, although we have mobile devices and web browser stuff. But one of the challenges we had was just understanding what we had available on racks and certain characteristics of them and having kind of a lightweight reservation system that could work with Zucchini and some of these other tools that we have that allowed us to have a shared pool of resources that that anyone could kind of jump on, play around with the device, and then return it back. And so DAWG actually has three parts. It has kind of a metadata system, it's got a reservation system, and then we have this thing called DAWG Show, which is actually, if you have the right hardware on the racks, and I think we have it all listed on the open source site, you can actually interact with these things directly through your browser. So it's kind of like a poor man's sling box, but it actually works really well. And then the other one, we've got a bunch of other ones too, but the magic wand is one that our teams that are doing Selenium type of testing, specifically around using Sauce Labs and in general browser and mobile stuff, they use magic wand as a way to simplify getting and configuring a driver. So it's kind of like you say in your test, I need Chrome running on OS X 10, 11 or something, you know, whatever it is. And you say, that's what I need. And I don't care where it comes from, whether it's a local device or whether it's from Sauce Labs or whatever else. And it kind of, that kind of handles that abstraction, you know. And I think beyond all the stuff that we've open sourced, I think there's so many great, there's so much great knowledge out there. And especially if you're using industry standard kind of stuff, there's really a great amount of knowledge out there. You know, I think, and beyond just test technology, I think I mentioned, DevOps and things like that. And I've really been inspired a lot by some of the work that's been done in that, in the DevOps area, in terms of just learning what's happening in there and applying that to testing. You know, there's just this, the commonality is just so, it's just so, so common of a problem, which is deploying servers and writing automated tests in production or in, on production devices. Is just, they're both chaos, and it's really just a matter of figuring out ways to you're never going to avoid the chaos. It's just a matter of figuring out ways to work with the chaos, you know?
Okay, Matt, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to avoid an automation project zombie apocalypse? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
That's a great question. gosh, I don't know that there's one answer. I think the best part of advice I can give you to anyone who's kind of struggling with this is you're dealing with the real world, and chaos in the real world is just exactly that. There is no way to escape it completely. And so really, you know, the best way to deal with this kind of stuff is kind of, you know, I've heard there was a saying that Bruce Lee had a long time ago, which is just be like water, right? So it's like, You're not gonna stop a river, but you can divert a river. And I think that's if you take that and say, well, okay, what's my river in my test? That's a great way to think about it. So yeah, you can get a hold of me. Probably the best way is just via email, Matt_Barbour, BARBOUR at cable.comcast.com. You can also get a hold of us, you know, via GitHub issues or things like that if you ever want to use any of these things. You know, we're very eager to help if anyone wants to get going and they don't really know where to start. You can always ping me, and I'm happy to do my best to help out. I think it's really just a community problem, you know.
Thank you, Matt, for your zombie killing test automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we covered in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/108. And while you're there, make sure to click on the sign up now free button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not go ahead and leave an honest review and rating in iTunes? Ratings and reviews really help with the rankings of the show in iTunes, and I really appreciate any feedback I can get to make Test Talks even better. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.